I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast.
That is Patrick, who's an author and a podcaster. You can check him out over at atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio, and I am a teacher and a podcaster and a musician, and you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. Today, we are joined by Lawrence McNaughton. He is a fantasy writer and the author of It Happened One Doomsday. I have it right here. You can check out his website, which is Lawrence McNaughton. It's MacNaughton. And you can follow him on Twitter at L McNaughton. Lawrence, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here. I'm glad to be here.
Why don't you tell us, you know, there's a lot that we can get into with the book and all of your other interests, but why don't you just let our listeners know a little bit of something about the book?
Well, it's a fun book. It's about kind of a nerdy crystal shop owner who has to, well, first off, she's in a world where there are these superpowered sorcerers, and she's really not one of them. She's just sort of a character you would normally see behind the scenes, kind of supporting everyone. She has a little bit of magic potential, but it turns out that when this hunky guy walks into her shop and his eyes are glowing red, she finds out that he's been cursed to transform into a creature who will bring about doomsday, and she's the only one who can save him and stop the end of the world.
You got to watch out for the hunky guys with red eyes. That's what my wife used to tell me, like, before we got together. She's like, was always very drawn to hunky guys with red eyes. I was the first non-hunky red-eyed man that... I'm just more like non-hunky, yeah. But awesome, that sounds good. We'll get more into the book and other aspects of the book as we get deeper into the show. But before we do that, I want to let people know, if you dig what Patrick and I do, and dig hearing these interviews with authors and other creative folks like Lawrence, consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can support us with $1 a month or more. If you support us at one of the higher levels, you can sit in on these live video chats and watch them as they're going on. You can get early access to certain episodes and all sorts of good stuff. I want to take a moment to thank the people that already support us. It really means the world to us. It gave us a big boost, not only financially, but just in enthusiasm for the show and trying to do an even better job every week and all that kind of stuff. So Patrick and I really thank you for supporting us. And if you enjoy the show every week, consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com.
You can get all that for $1.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you can get if you have the $5 level, you can get all the extra stuff and sitting on the live chat and all that kind of stuff. So check that out. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Lawrence, do you have a pick of the week?
Well, you know, I was thinking about this. I've got a couple of things that I'm really excited about. One is a movie, and the other one is a piece of software that can actually help you become more creative.
Well, let's hear them both then. You can give them both. That's fine.
I can do two.
That's allowed.
Okay. Has anyone recommended 10 Cloverfield Lane?
No.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, my God. This is my favorite movie of the year. If you like old-style Twilight Zone, where you've got some characters in a weird situation and they can't escape and something strange is going on and you're spending the entire episode trying to figure out what it is and then there's a twist at the end, if you like that, you will love 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Now, I feel like this is a movie that, because it's out of the theaters now, right? It's
right.
Like on DVD and digital, right, and all that kind of stuff now. I feel like this is a movie that there was a lot of secrecy when it was being made. I even heard things that the cast...
No one knew it was even being made.
Yeah.
Until the trailer went out. And I mean, they did 100% secrecy. The trailer went out and people went, what? Uh-huh.
And even I heard stories that the actors didn't even really know what they were acting in. And I mean, I don't know how accurate that is.
I think that they kept it too secret, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I talk to writers who are working on a book and they're hiding their big idea, that's called hiding the ball, and I think that's what they did in this case. They really should have let people know a little bit more about what's going on, because it is such an intense movie. I normally don't sit and watch a movie all the way through, and I could not turn this one off. I kept thinking, I've got to figure it out. Oh, this guy's lying about this, and this other thing is happening. And then 10 minutes later, okay, that's not what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because they're all trapped in a bomb shelter, and you're thinking, is there really a nuclear holocaust? Is something else going on? Is this guy just a psycho? You don't know. And I will guarantee you, you cannot predict the ending.
That's what I was thinking was that I think this movie, it was too secret, because I feel like you heard about it and it's like, mm-hmm. oh, okay. And then I feel like it just sort of came and went pretty fast. But mm-hmm. anything that I hear about in terms of people that actually saw it, it has really positive reviews for it. And, you know, it'll probably be one of those kind of cult films that will kind of grow in stature over the years. But I think you're right. Sometimes it's good, you know, that's a balance. I think if you're a creative person, whether you're an author or a musician or whatever you do, I think there's some people overhype things and are just, mm-hmm. you know, you can go too far with it one way. And I've seen bands do this. And obviously I think the most famous example is like Beyonce does that thing now where she just like drops an album out of nowhere. And it just, and in that mm-hmm. way that's great in some ways. Cause it's like, what, you know, and I think there used to be, especially with albums, there used to be so much mystery with a band. You know, mm-hmm. you think about something like Led Zeppelin. Like, no one really knew who, like, you know, Jimmy Page wasn't tweeting, like, just came up with a sweet guitar riff, everybody. You know, it was just all right. Like, oh, I think they worship Satan, and there's all this dark magic, and there's elves and stuff. I don't know what's going on.
They may have stolen some stuff from Spirit.
Yeah, and I think some people would like to go back to that, and I think there is a balance, but I think sometimes you can go too far, and people missed it, and if they did it, took a different approach to it, maybe it would have had a little more impact when it first came out. But now you're like the third or fourth person that's mentioned that to me recently.
Now you have to watch it.
Yeah,
and it's got two actors in it that I like, the guy from Roseanne and Blues Brothers 2000 and Oh Brother Where Art Thou, the big guy.
John Goodman.
Oh, John. Thank you.
And I'll tell you what, John Goodman is really excellent at switching from being a funny offbeat guy to being a total psychopath in the space of 2 seconds.
Yeah, the female lead in that is, she was in Scott Pilgrim. She was in the Die Hard movies. Mm-hmm. She played like John McClane's daughter. I think she's the one mm-hmm. that's now in the political thing with the ants that's on CBS.
And you know what I like about the characters she plays, especially in this movie, is she tends to play characters who are really strong.
Yeah.
Without being masculine.
Right.
You know, she's definitely a female character who has just an inner strength, and that makes you really root for her to succeed.
Yeah. I cannot for the life of me remember her name though, John.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll IMDb that later and put it in the show notes. But you also mentioned a piece of software, so I'd like to hear about that. So I always love when people have software picks. So what's
well, like it that? It's called Scapple, which is a bad name, I think.
Oh yeah,
that's
from Literature and Latte.
Yes. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, Patrick is a huge Scrivener ambassador.
I teach Scrivener a lot of times for PikeSpeak writers. Yeah.
That's awesome. I just got into Scrivener, so I'm still learning. So I might hit you up for some tips.
Hit my website, because I actually have a bunch of tips on there already.
Okay, cool. I will. So these same guys made a program called Scapple. And the idea of the program is it's supposed to be a mind mapping tool.
Right.
But I'm going to tell you how you can hack it to turn it into just the ultimate productivity tool. I use this thing probably half of every workday. What it's supposed to be is just a blank white screen. And if you double-click anywhere on the screen, it creates a text box that you can type in. You can double-click anywhere else on the screen, create another text box, and so on. And you can drag boxes to create lines in between them. You can do directional arrows, whatever you want. What it's meant for is you can come up with an idea, put it on your screen, and then come up with related ideas, and each one branches off and creates more and more ideas. And that's how you're supposed to use it, and it's fantastic for that. But here's what's cool. You can also use it as a virtual corkboard and move the virtual cards around any way you want and actually highlight them, copy them, and then paste them into a text document in the order that you highlighted them. Does that make sense?
Yes. So you just got into Scrivener. Are you on Mac or PC?
I'm on PC.
Okay.
I know that Scrivener has cards, but in Scrivener, they have to be in sort of a rigid grid.
No, they don't. You can
turn it off.
On the PC, they do. On the PC, they do. On Mac, there's the freeform corkboard.
Okay.
Where you can move anything around that you want.
Right. Well, what's interesting about Scapel is that you can get it down to almost an atomic level where you can have individual words or sentences, and you can use it as sort of, have you ever seen that magnetic poetry?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
has little phrases.
Yep.
It ends up being like that. So I have used it to craft everything from entire blog posts down to just little headlines where you're rearranging words and stuff. And you can just highlight them, copy them, and paste them. There's another layer of cool on top of that. You can actually drag a text document onto Scapel and tell it to break up each paragraph into a separate text box.
Nice.
So if you have a text document that you're working on, you can break it up, spread it out, expand each of these paragraphs with more text boxes, more stuff, and then rearrange it, put it back into order, and copy and paste it back into another text document.
Nice.
So what you end up with is you can have an individual board that is just, here's all the emails that I commonly send, and here's all the pieces of those emails, and then, you know, copy the individual pieces that you want to send to this particular person. You know, if for example, like I get a lot of emails about my books, and so I'll talk about if they like this book, they'll like this other book. If they like this short story, you know, here's the book that goes on after it, and I can just copy those individual boxes, paste them into a text document, and then go through and customize it and send it off. And I can do that in half the time of starting from scratch.
That's awesome. And I'm very excited for you because you're just starting with Scrivener and you have absolutely no idea how incredibly powerful it can be. I mean, and one of the things that bothers me is that there are so many features on the Mac that aren't available yet in Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that they were, because a lot of times when I'm teaching people how to use it, one of the things that comes up is like, I'll be going down the road, and I'm like, this is how you can do this and this and this and this. And someone goes, I don't have that. I can't do that. And I look,
right,
and they're on like an Asus or something. I'm like, ah, crap. Yeah, I'm sorry. You know, and the Windows version, you can't do that yet.
Hmm.
But yeah,
so hopefully they'll get that figured out.
Well, yeah, there's a long, complicated story behind that. But yeah, they're, instead of just porting it over and giving you a really shitty version of Scrivener that doesn't quite work well on PC, they have a Windows developer. And so they like prioritized the best features of the Mac version of Scrivener and they started developing them for Windows. And so it's interesting because the first version of the Windows Scrivener had more feature sets than the first version of the Mac one because they had already built all this stuff for Mac.
Hmm.
So they just kind of gave you the best of it.
So it's sort of a parallel development rather than...
It is, yes. Yeah. It absolutely is. And they're doing the same thing with their iOS version. So their iOS version of it is being developed specifically for iOS. So it's not... A lot of times what software companies do is they will build a piece of software and then they will just port it to something else. So a good example is QuickBooks. A lot of people use QuickBooks, right? They use it for, you know, like the QuickBooks for Home, to all this kind of stuff. QuickBooks was natively developed on Windows. They ported a version to Mac. The version that they ported to Mac is horribly broken.
Oh, no.
And there's a lot of stuff that doesn't work. For example, if you do an export, they may have fixed it by now, but at the time that I was using it, if you tried to export out your QuickBooks to give to an accountant, for example, who was using the Windows version, when they imported, the document was blank.
Oh.
So weird shit like that. Yeah, so I'm actually glad that they're doing a parallel development. I've heard nothing but good things about Scapel. A lot of people are using it, and they're using it in very similar ways to the way you are.
I love it.
Yep.
That's awesome. You know, it was, you guys were just reminded, Patrick, especially when we talk about sort of the Mac PC thing, was if you guys have seen Silicon Valley, that show on HBO, it's about like a tech startup, and the guys that run it are engineers, and they have their product, which is called Pied Piper, and it's like an in the cloud thing, and you know, they have all this funding, and it's doing great in the tech community. But when they sort of launch it as a beta, the public doesn't really understand it and know what to do with it. So they start doing these sort of community outreach. And it's really funny seeing these characters that are engineers trying to explain it to, you know, normal people. They're like, he's like, all right, well, what did you eat for breakfast this morning? Mm-hmm. And they were like, eggs. And what are your eggs made of? He's like, electrons. It was just like, you know, they were so kind of, you know, you can get so involved in something and you sort of forget that it's like, you know, especially when you're doing cross-platform things. Uh-huh. And when it's, and Literature and Latte, I know it started as one person. It was just one person developing it. I don't know for Scrivener, so I don't know if he has a team now.
Oh, they have a whole team now.
Yeah.
But the guy who originally created it is now doing the iOS development because the iOS developer that he hired apparently sucked.
Yeah. So when you're dealing with these either one person or small companies, it's hard for them to make it work for all of them. You know, when you're a huge company, you just throw as many engineers on it as you need and you get it to go. And even then, a lot of times, you know, what you could do on a Mac or a PC or vice versa, you know, sometimes it's usually whatever they're, you know, whatever the developer preferences that usually works better there. But, you know, you want it to work for both. But anyway, cool. I love when we get deep into that. So I think our listeners really like that. Well, hopefully.
The most requested thing I ever get from people is, when's your next class on Scrivener?
Yeah. Well, that's cool. That's awesome.
So I'm even in talks to do like a really in-depth one with Pikes Peak Writers. So.
Well, that's cool.
Sweet. And I want to get to that too, because Lawrence does a little bit of teaching stuff like that too. So we'll get into that later too. But before we do that, Patrick, what is your pick this week then?
My pick is going to be a couple of different things. I do want to remind people that I write a column for Kirkus Reviews. So if you're into graphic novels and you want something that's not superhero-y or mainstream, please go check out Kirkus Reviews and look at my blog. It's ATFMB there. Because I keep doing a ton of stuff there and I always forget to promote it. So please go check it out. My pick this week is the concept of the Humble Bundle.
Yes, I'm
so
familiar.
So there, if you haven't seen it yet, Humble Bundle is it's specifically for charity. And typically you can get a lot of stuff for a little bit of money. So as an example, I recently just bit the bullet. Someone had been texting me and sending me stuff that there was a Star Trek Humble Bundle, and it was Star Trek comics. And it was everything from the classic DC and Gold Key stuff all the way up through some of the stuff that IDW has been doing recently.
Was it reprints?
No, they're all digital.
Oh, okay.
In this case. So sometimes it's physical stuff. There is a physical book, I think, by Peter David that's getting sent to me, like a limited edition. But for the most part, it was all digital stuff. And basically you pay $35, and I want to say I got 100-something comics. I mean, it was ridiculous how many comics
wow.
they sent me.
What is that, 35 cents a comic?
Yeah, and a lot of them were classic stuff that I already had. You know, I've got my... my new shelves over here with all the comic book short boxes on them. And a lot of them I already had. And I was like, when it said classic, I started opening them. And I'm like, wait a minute, I have this. I have this one. Oh, yeah, Scotty's Wife. I remember that story. You know, stuff like that. And but the newer stuff is completely different. And I've never seen it before. And all I had to do was go out and get like a free comic book reader. And I could start reading them on my laptop. So that was kind of cool. But they do other stuff. Like there's been role-playing game versions where like you get a ton of Pathfinder adventure paths or something. Or you get a bunch of Dungeons & Dragons adventures. Or you get a bunch of books, like just regular science fiction or fantasy books. Mm-hmm. And you can sit there and depending on the level that you go with is what you get. And so they have like a base level. And then if you go up a tick, you unlock all of these books. And if you go up another tick, you unlock all of these books. And you can sit there and say how much you want to go to charity and how much you want to go to the publisher of the thing. And then you've got these little sliders and stuff. And it's like instant. You pay your money and you get your stuff. So
that's cool.
It's really cool. I like it.
I have seen ones too where I've seen them for software where you can get like different pieces of software.
There's one going right now for DRM free games on Steam.
Mm-hmm. And also I've seen it go where not only where it's how much you pay, but how much they make overall.
Yes.
Then they unlock some other things at the top. So if they make whatever the amount is, let's say it's, you know, $20,000 or whatever it is. It's like if they sell that much stuff, then they unlock these. So it's sort of it's kind of devious because it's like, hey, go and promote our stuff more because then you'll get more stuff even. Because the more people that do this, then the more we're gonna get. So it's a really good concept because in the end you still just get a hell of a deal because you end up getting like 10 bucks or whatever, and you can go very low with it if you just you don't get quite as much, but you know, sometimes it's just a couple bucks and you get like 10 bucks or
I want to say that like the base was 30 bucks to get everything, but I gave a little bit more and made sure that I slid it so that the little bit more that I gave all went to the charity.
Yeah, it's great. It's a really cool way to go about doing that stuff. So yeah, I always see that stuff pop up, and I always like it. And cool. My pick this week is going to be a recent book by Neil Gaiman. I don't think I've picked this yet. I don't believe I have. It is called The View from the Cheap Seats, Selected Nonfiction. Essentially, it's a big book. It's like 500 pages of this book. It is a lot of Neil Gaiman's speeches that he's given at various cons, a lot of forewords that he's written for books and albums and, you know, newspaper articles that he's written over the years. He's written a lot of nonfiction. It's pretty surprising, but there's a lot out there. And it's really wonderful. I like Neil Gaiman. I've read quite a few of his novels at this point. I haven't read his comics, although I know that's where I first became aware of him. I would used to get the Wizard, magazine every month, and it was always Neil Gaiman, number one writer, and he would always be at the top there. But I've always enjoyed Neil Gaiman, and this is a great book. If you are a creative person, he's just, you know, it's a lot of good bits of practical advice. But it's also just, it makes you really like Neil Gaiman more, which is most people really like Neil Gaiman a lot to begin with. He's just, you know, in reading this, what you discover is that as much of a creative person as he is, and as much prolific creator as he is, he's a fan. He is a fan of just so many different authors, so many different comics creators, movie directors, musicians, you know, because he's written a lot of like, liner notes for albums and things like that too, like for Lou Reed and Tori Amos and stuff. You just realize like this person is just, he's a big fan, and he loves art, and he loves taking it in, and he loves creating it. And if you're a person like that, it's a joy to read this. I really got a lot out of this book. So it's just came out a couple months ago, and it's called The View from the Cheap Seats, Selected Nonfiction by Neil Gaiman.
That's cool. Did you ever read his book back in the 90s with Terry Pratchett? They wrote a book about
Good
the
Omens.
End of the world. Yes, love that book.
I didn't read it. That's one of those ones that I haven't read, but he does talk.
Hilarious.
And he talks a lot about, there is a couple of essays on Pratchett about, you know, his experience doing that with him. And I think he sort of wrote a good eulogy for him that ran in one of the English newspapers too, which was quite moving. And it's really cool because he does talk about how that all, because that actually, you know, kind of came about before he'd written, I think he'd already been in comics for a while, but I don't know if any of Neil Gaiman's novels had been out at that point. So I think that might have been one of his earlier published. I could be wrong about the timeline on that, but I think
Snow Crash had come out.
Well, Snow Crash is Neil Stevenson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Different Neil.
That's okay. They're all good. All the Neils are good. I think, you know, that was when he was in the show, the Doogie Howser show. That was him too. Oh, that's Neil Patrick Harris. it's definitely a cool book. It's definitely worth reading. So Lawrence,
by the way, John, one of my favorite scenes in How I Met Your Mother is Barney is constantly talking about his blog. Don't you read my blog? Don't you read my blog? And then they finally did the Doogie Howser thing where it's like the end of the day and he sits down to write his blog, and it's the Doogie Howser.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I do just a quick aside. It's a good podcasting in joke, but there's the show. It's on Hulu now. I watched it a few months ago. It's called Superstore, which is, I believe, on NBC.
Yeah.
It's like workers in a Walmart, basically.
Right, and it's funny.
Yeah, it's very funny. I really enjoy it. But it's this – just apropos of nothing, it had no context, but there's this one assistant manager who's this woman, and she's just like very aggressive and kind of weird. And the manager at one point, I forget what the woman's name is, but let's just say Stephanie, because that's what I'm thinking of right now. He was like, and God, Stephanie, with your podcast, just get right to the interview. No one wants to hear your thoughts in the beginning. And it just made me laugh so much because, like, oh, we do that. We kind of ramble on in the beginning.
That's half the fun, though.
Yeah, exactly. But it just cracked me up because I guess she does, like, you know, a long – and some podcasts are like that. We always – unless it's certain kind of guests, usually we just start right away with our guest and we do our thing that we do in the beginning. But sometimes people pre-record the interview and then they do an intro before it. We do that sometimes too. But especially if you're one person and you do like a little monologue – there are some podcasts that I really like the interviews that I usually skip the monologue because it's just like, I don't really need 20 minutes of your thoughts about this. I just want to get to the interview with the guy from Journey or whatever, you know. Like, I listen to a lot of music podcasts where like the guy will do like
– John, don't stop believing.
I won't.
That's right.
Yes. But, you know, Lawrence, one of the things in your book and one of the things that I know you have a personal interest, which I'm really interested in, is your – you like to work on cars and you like muscle cars. And I would love to hear about that because
I have a Camaro that needs some work.
Cause that is something.
What year Camaro, by the way?
I'm sorry.
What year Camaro?
2000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It was the last of that body type.
That's cool.
And then they kind of brought it back like, a few years later, but yeah, that was supposed to be the last of the body type.
My wife drives a Trans Am, same body type.
I love the idea of cars. My father is a big car guy. My dad was an electrician, and I just really inherited none of those interests or skills. But there's still part of me that when I hear people talking about cars and especially older cars and muscle cars and things like that, there's still part of me that like really wants to be more involved in that or just be more interested in it. It's like it's something that feels like home to me because that's something that I think a lot of people are interested in, and especially like as a dude you're supposed to be into it, and I'm not personally, but there's still part of me that, you know, when I was an early teenager, I remember having posters of like Lamborghinis and Ferraris and things like that up on my wall. That was sort of the time too. I think a lot of people had posters
You know, especially in the summertime, I think one of the best things you can do is just find a local cruise night or a car show and just go check them out and strike conversations with some of the owners, and you learn so much about there's so many cool details about different kinds of cars and people's histories and that sort of thing.
So as an example, John, right up by there's a Sonic up the street from my house, and on Saturday nights there's a ton of really cool cars there. They just kind of all gather. But the one I'm specifically thinking of, and I don't know where you are inside of Colorado, Lawrence, but Golden does a thing in the summer where it's all the classic cars come out and they do like a little parade and they're all parked there and people can just go by and talk to the owners and look at the cars. And it's like a thing to bring everybody to downtown Golden.
That's cool. Yeah, I have a friend of mine who goes down there all the time. So I'm going to check it out this year.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
I actually met my wife because of cars.
Nice.
I have and still have a 67 Thunderbird.
Ooh.
And at the time, this was in the late 90s, she had a 65 Impala. And we kept parking in the same parking lot downtown. And one day, I got up the nerve to ask around, you know, who owns that cool Impala? And they said, oh, yeah, it's Cindy. And this beautiful blonde woman. And, you know, normally Fords, Chevys, they don't mix too well. But I went over there and said, hey, is that your Chevy? And, you know, before we know it, we're hanging out and detailing engines and all that sort of thing. The very first time I took her for a cruise in the T-Bird, I actually ran out of gas. did not plan it that way. So, but I still have that car today, and obviously the car's a lot older and needs more work. And a couple of years ago, I unwrapped the car. You know, it was in storage. I unwrapped it and cleaned it all up, got it started, and I had a Metallica tape in the tape deck, and it started playing. Am I Evil? And I thought to myself, what if there was a car like Stephen King's Christine, only it's a really, you know, badass muscle car, you know, with big engine, that sort of thing. And that became the crux of the idea for this character in my book, Hellbringer, which is actually a black muscle car possessed by a demon.
Nice. I have two questions, I think. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of or a member of the Colorado Thunderbird Club?
You know, I used to be, and I'm not anymore, but I probably should be.
Okay, because I know that they do a lot of stuff locally. Yeah. The second question, I think when Kripke created Supernatural, he was mm-hmm. trying to do the Route 66 show, but with monsters every week, you know, the two brothers on the road traveling. And I want to say that originally the car was going to be a Thunderbird.
Really?
And
that's cool.
He sought out a like a muscle car guy kind of person, and said, you know, for my muscle car, I've got a Thunderbird. And the guy said, no, that's not going to work for you at all. If you really want a cool car, you should go with the Impala.
Well, I got to tell you, and my baby favorite. Was Well, you know, my wife used to have an Impala. My favorite muscle car of all time is the Dodge Charger, like they had in Dukes of Hazzard.
Yep.
And the in 1969, Dodge put out a version of that that had a nose cone and a big wing on the back, and it was so fast that NASCAR actually outlawed it.
Oh, interesting. And
that's the car that's in my book.
Well,
so
I know there's not a lot of Chargers left because of Dukes of Hazzard.
In part because of that, yeah.
Because they kept, I mean, every time they jumped one, it got trashed.
Yeah. Well, and they rebuilt some of them. I will say, though, that a lot of muscle cars, not just Chargers, but just in general, a lot of them have just been driven until the wheels fall off because mm-hmm. they're so fun to drive.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, now these cars are 50 years old.
Yeah.
So.
One of the things I it's up on Amazon's streaming service, and I haven't gotten around to watching it yet. I know the director, the guy that made this particular documentary on cars, it's Adam Carolla, and I used to listen to his podcast all the time. I haven't listened to his podcast in a long time, but he's a big car guy. I always used to talk about it on, and he was really into Paul Newman. And right. Paul Newman apparently, and I didn't, because he would talk about it all the time on the podcast, and that's apparently what this documentary is about. It's about Paul Newman's life as a race car driver, which I did not know. And I want to watch this doc because I when I listened to Carolla's podcast, he was always talking about making this documentary. It took him like 2 years to make it or whatever. And just about how he had gotten into it through a movie that he was making. It was a movie where he played a race car driver. And after that, he didn't want to act anymore. He just wanted mm-hmm. to race cars and it got into that world. And basically, that was his acting choices from then on were just, I'll make a movie a year so I can fund my car addiction.
A bad way to do it.
Yeah, and that's what he did. He would take a good role, like he, you know, did good stuff, and then just put it mostly into racing. And what he loved about it was no one cared who he was. You know, he wasn't Paul Newman actor. There was no it was you won or you lost, and that was it. And that was a lot of the joy that he got out of racing and being in that world. And I just, you know, you meet, like you said, I think a good thing to do is to go to those cruise nights or whatever. I think there's so much history, especially if you're talking about American, well, I shouldn't say that because there's all obviously lots of great European cars and everything too, but there's just a lot of great history wrapped up, and people can tell you about the time and when they bought it and
And it's its own culture too.
Yes, I think so.
And the other Hollywood guy that was really into cars and racing was Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, the Steve McQueen car chase between a Mustang and a Charger, I watched that over and over again before I wrote the car chases in my book. And if you read it carefully, if you're familiar with that, you will see where I transplanted some things from San Francisco into Denver, and I have a car chase between a Mustang and a Charger. So it was a lot of fun to write.
That's awesome.
Nice. One of the other big things in your book is crystals. And yes. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about crystals, how you use them in the book. And you had even mentioned pre-show about Dan Aykroyd and yes. crystals. And, so maybe well, tell us something about that.
Do you have a crystal behind you that's glowing?
Yes. Okay. It's on a little LED light. That crystal that's behind me is selenite, which is actually a I'm spacing the word. When light travels through a substance.
Like a prism?
Yeah, no.
Prismatic?
No, they use it in telecommunications.
Oh.
Fiber optics?
Fiber optic. Yeah, thank you. I don't know why I blanked out of that word. Yeah. Selenite is a fiber optic crystal. It occurs that way naturally. So when you put a light across it, it hardly does anything. But you put a light along it, and the entire thing will light up. Hmm. So that's very cool. One of the things that I'm going to do when I have bookstore appearances after my book comes out next week is I'm bringing a selection of crystals to stores. And so people can actually see different kinds of crystals, what they look like, they can handle them, and they can see neat effects like the fiber optic properties of selenite. I have a selenite wand that's over a foot long. It's a natural crystal, but you can see a picture on my website. You put a light on it, it lights up like a lightsaber. That's very cool.
I think that's a really cool idea for bookstore appearances too. And I'm assuming you're going to be in your Thunderbird and take everybody for a ride. Hey man, you buy a book. Buy a book and get a ride in the Thunderbird, man.
Yeah, I can see it now at tattered cover.
Right. So.
Oh, that's right. You're going to be in Aspen Grove.
I am. And you know, everybody says there's a tattered cover at Aspen Grove. Yes, there is.
Yes, there is.
And I'm going to be there on Tuesday the 19th at 7 p.m.
I think that's when this episode will be going live, too, so I think it's good time.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Well, if you're listening to this on Tuesday the 19th, come on down and check it out. Very cool. So my wife has always collected crystals, and just because they're neat. I never realized just how many different kinds of crystals there are out there. I mean, I'm familiar with quartz, you know, amethyst, that sort of thing. But one day, my wife is an artist, and one day we were out getting some wine for an art opening, and sitting in the corner of the liquor store is Dan Aykroyd. And I'm thinking, that is Dan Aykroyd. It's the weirdest thing. So at the time, he had just come out with his Crystal Head Vodka, and he was promoting it. And one of the things that he was talking about was that he filters the vodka through Herkimer diamonds for purity. Herkimer diamonds, by the way, are just a form of really clear quartz. So I started thinking about, there are a lot of people out there with these metaphysical beliefs about crystals that, for example, amethyst can protect you from psychic influences, or halite can break negative patterns. And you can go to these New Age shops and buy these crystals, and they'll give you a little spiel about all the things that they supposedly do for you. Being a guy of science, I'm a little skeptical. But what's neat about it is that there are all these existing beliefs about them. And so the more I started to study them, I thought, what if I took these and I amped them up to, you know, a Harry Potter kind of level?
Nice.
And what if halite didn't just break disruptive patterns in your life, but could actually break the patterns of magical spells. So it becomes an anti-magic stone. By the way, halite is just a fancy word for rock salt. Mm-hmm. So it'll also de-ice your driveway.
And protect you from vengeful spirits.
Yeah. So, you know, the more that I started to research it, the more I got into it. And I started going to all these lapidaries in small mountain towns where you go and it's just a room in somebody's house where they have all these shelves full of crystals. And the more I started to collect little crystals and talk to people about them, it's almost like the magic system in my book kind of built itself. It was very exciting, very different. And it was a lot of fun.
Have you gone to a lot of the little mountain towns here in Colorado, like Idaho Springs and different places? There always seems to be crystal shops.
Right everywhere.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And so, you know, for example, there's a silvery crystal, galena, that it kind of looks like a chunk of chrome almost, and it tends to break off in cubes. In ancient Egypt, they used to believe that galena would protect you against the evil eye. So there were pharaohs that actually... Possibly. So there were pharaohs that would line their eyes with galena, with flakes, you know, make them all sparkly. And so in my book, that becomes very important. And so I was able to take these existing beliefs and just sort of, you know, take them and run with them.
That's great. That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, the book sounds like a really wonderful combination of a lot. I was thinking, like, wow, we talked about muscars, talked about crystals. We got a little tutorial on a scaffold. A lot of good stuff we went over today. So if that kind of stuff sounds interesting to you, I would encourage everybody to go and check out Lawrence's book. It's called It Happened One Doomsday, Lawrence McNaughton.
And it's launching when?
On Tuesday the 12th.
Okay,
so I got to tell you,
July 12th. Okay.
July 12th. Sorry. I just want to say that the feedback I've been getting on this is bigger than anything I've ever done before. I mean, Library Journal calls it engaging. Publishers Weekly calls it fascinating. RT Book Reviews said it's terrific. Nearly 1,000 people have added on Goodreads.
Wow.
So I'm amazed and humbled. I had no idea this was going to be this big.
Awesome.
Well, that's great. Congratulations. And I will put it out there that it is a website, lawrencemcnaughton.com, and on Twitter, at LMcNaughton. So go and follow Lawrence there. And you mentioned some bookstore appearances. Any con appearances coming up for you?
You coming to Mile High Con?
You know, I was thinking about it. I was there a couple of years ago. I had a great time. So I
you
might
should come
be
hang
this
out.
Year.
Come hang out. We'll take care of you.
Okay. I'll be there.
Excellent. That easy, everybody. Okay, for us this week, once again, if you dig the show, consider becoming one of our patrons. Go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything else you want to mention?
It's just funny. I've mentioned it a couple times. I'm working with Rose, who is the programming director for Mile High Con, and I'm working with Linda, who's a chairperson. And it's just, you know, it's funny. Rose is like, I trust you, Patrick, because you love Mile High Con. And that's true. I do. So that's why, you know, I'm like, Lawrence, you're local, dude. You got to come to Mile High Con. And if you're in any of the surrounding states of Colorado, come to Mile High Con. It's a great local con. It's so much fun. It's in October. And we managed to get some really, really cool names. So come hang out with us. And Lawrence, there's almost always a Writer's Night mixer where you can just come, hang out, grab a beer if you drink or something else, and just talk to other writers and kind of network and have a good time.
That sounds great.
Yep. Angie's right, there. Everybody. Warren's there.
All the cool kids are going to be there.
Yes.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me.
Say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?